Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Grantville Gazette, Volume 8. Edited by Eric Flint and Walt Boys. Narrated by P.J. Oakland. Descartes, Before the Whores. Eric Flint. Magdeburg, capital of the United States of Europe. Rathaus, office of the police chief. October 20th, 1636.
I'm sorry, guys, but that's the way it is. We have to put Descartes before the whores.
Bill Riley, the city of Magdeburg's police chief, leaned back in his chair and planted his hands firmly upon his desk, in that ancient gesture of bosses that signified, "Here I sit, you can do no other." Gotthilf Hoch glanced at his partner, Byron Chieske. He decided that this was an issue that had enough of an uptime, what do you call it, flavor, aura, that he could reasonably keep quiet while Chieske handled it. Like Riley, Byron was an American. And who but Americans would get this worked up over the fate of a man whom Gotthilf had not only never heard of, but was a foreigner to boot? A foreigner twice over, in fact. Born a Frenchman and still a subject of the French crown, but one who now resided in the Netherlands. And not any of the Catholic parts of the lowlands either, like Brabant, even though the foreign fellow in question was himself a Catholic. No, the man had been residing in the Calvinist portions of the Netherlands since he emigrated from France back in... Gotthilf searched his memory, trying to bring up that item from the briefing they'd just gotten from the police chief. Back in 1618, almost 20 years ago now, and the man was only in his early 40s. Typical Catholic, Gotthilf thought disdainfully. This Descartes fellow had apparently left France in order to take advantage of the free-thinking, more free-thinking at least, attitudes in Holland, but still stubbornly refused to give up his papist heresies. Not that many of the lowlands Calvinists weren't also intolerant and narrow-minded, especially the more rabid Gomarists. For that matter, although Gotthilf was a proper Lutheran, there were plenty of Lutherans who suffered from the sin of pride, so certain they were that they knew every jot and tittle of God's designs for the world. Gotthilf had thought so even before the Ring of Fire and the arrival of the Americans, whose advocacy of freedom of religion had been congenial to him. But his partner was already protesting, so Gotthilf broke off his ruminations.
No way of knowing if this...
Byron wrapped his fingers on one of the sheets atop Riley's desk.
So-called ransom note is even legitimate. I mean, for Pete's sake, Bill, look at the thing. It's like somebody's idiot notion of what a ransom note looks like based on watching B-grade cop movies. In the 17th century?
Chieske threw up his hands.
Is kidnapping even a recognized crime in this day and age?
As sympathetic as he was to his partner's stance, Gotthilf's stubborn honesty forced him to state,
Yes, although it's called abduction. But, Byron, whoever's behind this probably did get the idea, both for the crime itself as well as the ransom note, from watching uptime movies. They're not all that uncommon anymore, even here in Magdeburg, much less in Grantville, and lots of people make a visit to Grantville these days.
The police chief grunted his agreement.
He's right. One of the principal tourist attractions in Grantville are the theaters showing American movies that we had on VHS or DVDs, and even some old Betamax tapes. The last time I was there, both the Criterion and the Majestic theaters were running 18 hours a day, and they were building a new theater complex that was supposed to operate around the clock.
He leaned forward and tapped his own forefinger on the same sheet of paper that Chieske had wrapped with his fingers.
Just like Gotthilf says, that's probably where the perp or perps got the idea in the first place.
Scowling, Byron stared down at the sheet. Upon it were pasted letters obviously cut from different sources, mostly from cheap newspapers, judging by the quality of the cut-out little pieces of paper. We got philosopher Descartes send It went on like that. We got philosopher Descartes, send $50,000, or he sleeps with the fishes. Instructions will follow.
Sleeps with the fishes, snorted Chesky. One thing's for sure, somebody watched The Godfather.
He reached back his long arms, planted his hands on the armrests of his chair, and eased himself down. Once seated, he gave the police chief a look that came very close to an outright glare.
I still don't see why whatever happened to this Descartes guy is more important than three missing women.
For Christ's sake, Byron, we're talking about whores.
No, Bill, we're not. We're talking about people.
Not for the first time, Gotthilf was glad that Byron was his partner rather than Riley. He respected the American police chief's experience and abilities, but he didn't much like the man. Riley had the grace to look embarrassed for a moment, but it was a brief moment. Within seconds, he was back to scowling.
My point wasn't that whores aren't people, which you know damn good and well, but that whores disappear all the time for 100 reasons.
He slumped a little in his chair and shook his head.
Look, I got no choice, he said.
He pointed to the ceiling above him with his forefinger.
I got pressure coming down, big time, from on high.
From who? Byron asked.
The princess.
Christina? What does she care? And anyway, she's only 9 years old. How much clout can she have?
Riley's scowl deepened.
Which part of the word princess are you having the most trouble with, Byron? How about the phrases sole heir to the throne, and future empress of the USE. Those give you trouble, too.
He slapped the desk with the palm of his hand.
Look, it's settled. Descartes before the whores.
He lifted the hand and made a shooing gesture with it.
So off you go. See if you can find out who's got him and where they're holding him. I don't think we're dealing with mastermind arch-criminals here. This is more likely the work of Elmer Fudd than Fu Manchu.
Gotthilf didn't understand the specific American references that Riley was using, but the gist of it was clear enough. He thought the police chief was probably right, too. Chesky rose.
You'll let us know when those instructions come in, I assume.
Riley nodded. 15 seconds later, Gotthilf and Byron were moving down the corridor outside, headed for the entrance to the municipal building. Magdeburg, capital of the United States of Europe, Royal Palace, October 20th, 1636.
I killed him, Caroline. The encyclopedia says so.
Caroline Platzer glanced at the window of Princess Christina's room in the Royal Palace. Bill Riley's finger pointing at the ceiling of his office had been purely symbolic. Magdeburg's municipal building was several blocks away from the royal palace. Perhaps fortunately, the room had no view of the Elbe. By this point, Caroline was ready to dunk her charge in the river. She wouldn't actually drown Christina, of course. Just give her a good soaking. The child could be a burden sometimes.
You did not kill René Descartes, Caroline said firmly. He died of pneumonia. It was my fault. I made him attend me early in the morning in Sweden, where it gets cold in the winter. Don't tell me I didn't, Caroline. It's in the encyclopedia. I can read, you know, 4 languages, almost 5 now.
The princess wasn't boasting. The girl was almost frighteningly precocious.
For pity's sake, Christina, that all happened decades from now and in another universe. You haven't done anything to Descartes in this one.
Christina's expression was mulish.
Well, maybe not. But I still feel responsible for him. And now he's been abducted, right here in Magdeburg. We have to do something, as I said to the police chief.
And hadn't Bill Riley been thrilled to get that royal attention, thought Caroline. She didn't particularly care for the police chief, but at the moment he had her sympathy. Christina had been in an agitated mood for weeks now, ever since her betrothed had left to join her father fighting the Ottomans besieging Linz. She'd become very attached to Ulrich and emotionally dependent on the Danish prince she'd be marrying in a few years. Well, more than a few. It'd be 7 or 8 years before she was old enough to have a wedding.
"We have to do something,"
Christina repeated. She charged for the door leading, eventually, the palace was large and in places labyrinthine, to the street. Caroline followed, not quite running, thinking thoughts of princesses tossed into rivers. Magdeburg, capital of the United States of Europe. Ratskeller, October 20th, 1636.
"I insist," said Elisabeth von Schwarzenfels, waving a chapbook under Byron Chesky's nose. "I must bring Descartes before the Horus."
The American policeman looked up at her, frowning.
"Before the... what?"
"The Horus. The Eye of Horus."
Von Schwarzenfels rotated the chapbook in her left hand so that Chesky could see the cover. With the forefinger of the other hand, she imperiously jabbed at the illustration across the top. It was an eye of Horus. Sort of. Allowing for the pronounced suggestion that this particular Horus was a peeping Tom. Byron groaned. Not at the illustration, but at the sight of the chapbook's title. The National Observer. Inquiring minds want to know. "Oh, for God's sake," he said, lapsing into the blasphemy that he usually avoided in deference to 17th-century mores. "That rag!"
"It's a matter of freedom of the press," said the young woman.
Elisabeth von Schwarzenfels was dressed in a satin-tabbed bodice with full sleeves, dyed gold and lavender and trimmed with silver braid, along with a matching petticoat. Her bodice was laced up with a coral ribbon over a stomacher, with a matching ribbon set in a V-shape at her front waist and tied in a bow to one side. A ribbon and a string of pearls decorated her auburn hair. In short, she had the appearance of exactly what she was, a member of the German upper nobility, the Hochadel, but one whose family was not especially wealthy. The clothing was well-designed and well-made, but not extraordinarily expensive. Gotthilf busied himself with quaffing from his stein of beer. He was seated on the other side of the table from his partner. After finishing their discussion with Riley, the two of them had repaired to the tavern in the basement of the city hall to discuss the case of Descartes in a more congenial setting. Von Schwarzenfels had tracked them down there less than 45 minutes after they'd left the police chief's office. How she'd managed to do that was a mystery to Gotthilf. Perhaps an even bigger mystery to the level-headed policeman was the woman's evident devotion to a profession that would seem quite unsuitable to such a one as she. Not only had Elisabeth von Schwarzenfels chosen to become a journalist, but one who devoted most of her time to writing for a magazine which, in the short time since it had been launched, had already become disreputable. The National Observer was what the uptimers called a scandal sheet, or just the pithier term rag that his partner had used.
"Freedom of the press," Elisabeth repeated. "I insist on reporting on your progress in apprehending the scoundrels who abducted one of Europe's most famous philosophers."
Gotthilf laughed and gestured to an empty chair.
"Litza, have a seat and join us for a beer. I'm getting a crick in my neck from looking up at you. And stop pretending. You never heard of Descartes any more than we did, until he got taken a short time ago. He's not famous now."
Von Schwarzenfels looked stubborn.
"Well, he will be famous, Gotthilf. I know. I asked Melissa Maley. She said this Descartes fellow will be, already was in the world she came from, one of the most famous thinkers of all time."
Chesky looked over at his partner. Hoch shrugged.
"I've known Litza for a while, Byron. If we don't let her come along, she'll just follow us and be an even bigger nuisance."
Privately, although he wasn't about to say it out loud, Gotthilf thought Litza might even be of help to them. He'd been on friendly terms with the young noblewoman since she got back to Magdeburg from a recent adventure. One thing he'd learned about her was that when she got interested in a subject, she would pursue it indefatigably. And she seemed to have a genuine knack for getting information out of people. The articles she wrote for the National Observer had quite a bit of real substance to them. Her prose was terrible, though. Really, really terrible. Magdeburg, capital of the United States of Europe. Rathaus, police headquarters. October 21st, 1636.
Descartes before the...
Hoarse from her overly long and passionate peroration to Magdeburg's mayor, Otto Guericke, on the necessity to save one of history's greatest philosophers, Melissa Maley broke off from her current, equally passionate, if not yet as overly long, peroration to the two policemen who'd been assigned to the case.
Cough, cough. Sorry, she said. Before the publication of his Discourse on the Method, that happened in the year 1637 in the universe I came from, Descartes was an obscure figure to most people. So it's not at all surprising that neither of you had heard of him. In this universe,
she frowned, searching her memory for what she remembered about Descartes, most of which came from her perusal of the encyclopedias in Magdeburg's city library that morning. The course she'd taken on the history of philosophy in college was a long ways back.
I'm not sure what'll happen in this universe.
She gave Byron Chesky and Gotthilf Hoch a stern look.
Assuming that Descartes isn't just murdered outright, as his kidnappers are threatening to do.
We'll do our best to prevent that, said Byron. He was trying to be reassuring, but to Melissa he just sounded stolid. She sighed and ran fingers through her hair. It was completely gray now, and a dull and dismal shade of gray at that, to her mind. That caused Melissa some never-admitted-aloud but genuine distress. The discreet and demure uptime hair coloring she'd used since her mid-40s, and for a while after the Ring of Fire, had all vanished some time ago. And Melissa simply didn't have the temperament to use the more garish types of hair coloring available in the 17th century.
Anyway, she continued, the main thing he'd been working on was a work called Treatise on the World, but he hid that away after Galileo was condemned because he'd pretty much supported Galileo's astronomical views.
Gotthilf frowned.
But Galileo wasn't...
Wasn't condemned, Melissa finished for him. No, he wasn't, in this universe. That's mostly because of Larry Mazar,
she added with a great deal of hometown pride.
So who knows? He might wind up publishing Treatise on the World after all.
The stern look returned.
Assuming you can manage to keep him from being killed.
We'll do our best, said Byron stolidly. Once Melissa had left, Byron shook his head.
I'd still rather be looking for those missing girls. This case...
He shook his head again.
I got no idea where to even start.
Elisabeth von Schwarzenfels, who'd charged off the afternoon of the day before after receiving a tip, came charging into the office where Byron and Gotthilf had invited Melissa Maley to provide them with some background.
Someone saw him, she exclaimed.
She was practically bouncing with excitement.
Just 2 days ago, Descartes before the Horace.
The Horace?
Gotthilf and Byron glanced at each other.
What would a philosopher be doing in that dive?
Chesky wondered.
Gotthilf shrugged.
Maybe he's fond of bad music and worse women.
Or was looking for chewing tobacco, Byron said, followed by a snort of derision. The Horace was a tavern to the west of Magdeburg's Neustadt, about a mile from the Navy Yard. The owner fancied a decor that included imitations of uptime mementos, one of the most prominent of which was a mail pouch advertisement next to the entrance.
You will never find a more wretched hive of scum and villainy, said Elisabeth.
Chesky rolled his eyes.
Give me a break.
I like that movie,
protested Elisabeth.
Magdeburg, capital of the United States of Europe. Inside Horace Tavern, Greater Magdeburg. October 21st, 1636. Elisabeth looked around the central room of the tavern, scrutinizing the patrons. At this time of the day, there were only four of them. All three who were awake were clearly inebriated. Presumably, the man who was slumped back in his chair, his eyes closed and snoring, was drunk also.
"These are not the philosophers we're looking for," she pronounced.
Byron grimaced. Gotthilf smiled. He'd been quite taken by the Star Wars film himself, enough to have watched it twice. The tavern keeper behind the counter along one side of the room, what uptimers would have called the bar, just looked puzzled. The man wasn't the owner of the establishment, just an employee, and from what Gotthilf had been able to determine, he seemed not much better informed of the world around him than the yeast in the beer he served.
"When is Eberhardt going to return, then?" asked Chieske.
He'd given up trying to discover the owner's whereabouts, since the tavern keeper's only response to that question, which the uptime policeman had now asked three times, was a sullen shrug. The tavern keeper shrugged again. Sullenly. Gotthilf continued his examination of the Horace's interior decor. This was the fifth time he'd come into the establishment, and he was looking for anything that might have changed since the last time he was here. There was no particular reason for doing so. He was just trying to pass the time while his partner continued his fruitless interrogation of the man behind the counter. Next to the entrance was the mail pouch advertisement that had been there the first time Gotthilf had entered the Horace. That had been 8 months ago. Somewhere around that time. To the right of that was an octagonal uptime stop sign, whose red color was starting to fade, or more likely was a downtime replica that had never been a bright red to begin with. To the right of the sign was an uptime television set, perched on a ledge. Gotthilf had no doubt that was genuine, since no one would have bothered to make an imitation TV set that was obviously old, decrepit, and non-functioning. The rest of the decor on the wall behind the counter was of no great note. Neither was the billiards table nearby, which was downtime made, but of the American pool design. More interesting was the large sign hanging on the wall facing the entrance. In Fraktur script it read, "Nunc est bibendum. Nunc bede libero pulsanda tellus." The Latin translated roughly as, "Now we must drink and stamp the ground with a free foot." It was a quote from one of the odes of the ancient Roman poet Horace, after whom the tavern was named. How the tavern's owner, Konrad Eberhardt, who knew no Latin and had never been known to set foot inside a church of any denomination since his arrival in Magdeburg, had come across those odes was a mystery. As was, for that matter, everything else about the man. Gotthilf thought the likelihood that Konrad Eberhardt was his real name was about the same as the likelihood that he was a former ballet dancer, which, given his stubby legs and impressive girth, Gotthilf placed somewhere between fat chance and hell freezes over. Gotthilf tried to think of any reason a philosopher would have come to such an establishment. Besides alcoholic beverages of poor quality and the company of prostitutes who were no better, he couldn't think of any. Either this Descartes fellow was very short of funds, or he just had a taste for low life, what his uptime partner sometimes called slumming. Neither seemed very likely to Gotthilf, especially the first reason. A man who could support himself without doing any visible labor wouldn't presumably be so short of money that he'd have to make do with the entertainment available at the Horace. On the other hand, what did Gotthilf Hoch know about philosophers? Being honest, not much of anything. "Let's go," said Byron, who'd finally given up trying to get any useful information from the bartender. When he advanced his two very tentative hypotheses to Chieske after they'd left the tavern, the American policeman shook his head.
"I think it's probably even simpler than that. We still haven't found out where Descartes was staying."
The Horus doesn't have any rooms to let, protested Gotthilf. At least, I saw no sign of any.
Neither did I. But he might have been staying in the vicinity and just happened to be walking by the Horus when Leitz's informant spotted him.
Gotthilf came to an abrupt halt and slapped his forehead.
Ah, stupid! Of course! I assumed he was going into the place, but he could have just been passing in front of it.
He looked around. This part of Greater Magdeburg wasn't a slum, but that was mostly because, like almost all parts of the city, the construction was too new to have started decaying. Still, it was several steps down from the sort of neighborhood Gotthilf would have expected to find one of the world's greatest minds choosing to reside in. Byron, who'd also come to a halt, gave a little shrug.
Who knows?
He started walking toward the Rathaus again.
Let's see if we can track down Melissa. She might know something she doesn't even realize she knows.
Indeed, so it proved.
Interesting, she mused. One thing I learned from the study I just did of what information we have on Descartes is that he was an odd duck in all sorts of ways. One of them is, a philosopher, go figure, he never owned very many books. Apparently he didn't like to read much. Another is that he moved constantly, from town to town and from lodging to lodging. So it's quite possible that he'd taken a room somewhere in the vicinity of the Horus. And there's one other thing.
Triumphantly,
I'm pretty sure I know why Descartes came to Magdeburg in the first place. That was another unsolved mystery, wasn't it?
Gotthilf wouldn't have labeled that question a mystery himself. After all, lots of people came to Magdeburg every day for all sorts of reasons. Still, it was true that they hadn't yet uncovered Descartes' reason.
Somebody with his description went to the hospital 3 days ago and tried to get an interview with James.
Byron looked puzzled.
With Dr. Nichols? Why? Did the guy say he was sick? And did your husband agree to see him?
Gotthilf had to struggle not to laugh, seeing the prim and disapproving expression on Melissa's face. In point of fact, she and Dr. James Nichols were not married, although they had been living together and enjoying conjugal relations almost since the Ring of Fire. Apparently, no downtimer could ever make any sense of it. Maylie found a source of pride in the fact that she and Nichols were flouting convention. There was a witty little saying that had spread widely in the years since the Ring of Fire. All Americans are weird some of the time, and some Americans are weird all of the time. Melissa, if not her paramour, was generally considered to be pretty far over to the weird all-of-the-time end of that spectrum, at least by those who found her political and social views rather abhorrent. Melissa shook her head.
James didn't see him for the simple reason that he's not in town. He went to Dresden for a few days to help them set up the operation of their new hospital. But I'm willing to bet the reason Descartes wanted to see him wasn't because Descartes himself was feeling ill. I checked with the people who saw the fellow, and they said he didn't seem sick.
So why'd he want to see Dr. Nichols? Asked Byron.
I think it was because Descartes must have read a biography of himself somewhere and learned that his daughter Francine is. Well, she's not sick now. But in the universe we came from, she died, would die, will die, you parse the grammar any way you want, about 4 years from now. The girl is a year old. She's scheduled to die in 1640 from scarlet fever. Of course, that'll never happen because of the butterfly effect. But who's to say she won't die even earlier from some other disease? Child mortality's horrible in this day and age. Still is, even with the medical knowledge we uptimers brought with us.
Byron grunted.
So, you're saying Descartes showed up here in Magdeburg hoping... for what exactly? If his daughter's not sick yet, what's Dr. Nichols supposed to do?
Melissa shrugged.
I imagine Descartes wanted James to agree to treat his daughter if and when she does get sick, which she's almost bound to these days. Especially if she's not living.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?